California, here I come.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
As long as they keep on making animated Star Wars, Hulk Molinax and Chris Honeywell will be on the case. Welcome to J-Guys and Jedi, a project that began with Clone Wars and now may never end.
Hi everyone, welcome to a brand new episode of J-Guys and Jedi. We try bi-weekly podcast talking about some Star Wars. And today, we're going to be continuing our Legacy Expo coverage, because I recently went to Legacy Expo. Go listen to the last episode if you want to hear all about that. Also, if you hear purring, Zeb is in my lap because he's very mad that he can't take his afternoon nap in my desk chair, because I'm sitting here, so you might hear a cat. You want to say something? Stop eating my cords. Yeah. So, what this is the panel that I did at Legacy Expo. The panel was called Life Day Paved the Way, How the Holiday Special Created All Star Wars Television. Honestly, this was just an excuse to talk about the history of Lucasfilm Animation, but I also love the Holiday Special and I wanted to talk about it more. Zeb, why are you eating things on my desk? I also want to say a big special thanks to Jacob from Legacy Expo for giving me the audio and the video for this panel. And then after this, when you get to the end of the panel, you're going to hear my interview with Barbara Hambly. Barbara Hambly is a Star Wars Expanded Universe author. She is most notably wrote the novels Children of the Jedi and Planet of Twilight. And she was delightful. We talked about all sorts of things from writing romance to fan fiction, why women should be writing Star Wars, and so much more. So the one thing I will say is both of these are up on the Geeky Waffle. I probably like one of the few times I'll be like, you should go listen to this somewhere else and not here. But like, my panel is already up on thegeekywaffle.com. There's links to it in the show notes. And the thing about this is that it was a visual presentation. And being a visual presentation, it was a PowerPoint. And I actually like wrote jokes into the PowerPoint. So I actually suggest watching it. But if you don't want to sit there for an hour and watch it, because it's on the website, it's not on YouTube. I understand. And you can also already watch my interview with Barbara over there as well. So sit back, relax, enjoy, and here is my panel from Legacy Expo. Oh, I need to do the spiel. Legacy Expo was a Star Wars Expanded Universe convention in Burbank back in September. And they do have more ideas and plans coming up soon. They're very coy about it. And it sounds like they're going to have something in 2027. And they're going to be also eyeing, I think that's something to the Star Wars Celebration. And they're also eyeing 2028 for the next potential show. So just keep an eye on their socials and stuff. And now I need to finish up because Zeb's trying to get back into his seat for his afternoon nap. So bye everybody, enjoy.
Oh my god, let's talk about the holiday special, y'all. Hi! So, hello everybody, welcome to How the Holiday Special Created All of Star Wars Television. My name is Hope Molinax. I'm a freelance journalist. I've worked for a number of publications over the years. This weekend, I'm representing the Geeky Waffle. We are a women-led organization. We talk about a variety of things from movies, TVs, a lot of Disney. Our Star Wars podcast is called Space Waffles. And I'm also a cast member on For Light and Dice. It is a Star Wars TTRPG podcast where we're trying not to die in Star Wars. Not so successful in some cases. And I'm actually here because of that second one, because my two fellow co-podcasters are both huge Legends fans, and they talked about it so much that I decided to give Legends a try. So I'm a newbie and a baby to Legends, but there's one thing I really loved before meeting the two of them, and I love the holiday special. I know it's a mess, but it's one of my favorite things. And it's something that we're seeing is coming more and more into canon. The holiday special has become very prominent, and I actually argue that it's become so important that we're seeing it in other franchises as well. James Gunn has said that he was a huge fan of the holiday special. And I would argue it's one of the most influential pieces of Star Wars media. for a lot of different reasons. It's the first appearance of Cheek. We have Concepts of Life Day. And my personal favorite is Slice of Life Storytelling. We do not have time to get into it today, but if you stop me, I will absolutely tell you how Mala, Gormanda, and Akmina are Andor level characters. Yes, I said those words. Stop me. I will talk to you about it. But there was one thing that absolutely changed Star Wars forever. Boba Fett. I'm kidding. It's the story of the faithful Wookiee. But the story of the faithful Wookiee is the foundation of all Star Wars television. And to really understand like how and why it's important, we have to have a really good concept of what was happening in animation in the United States at the time. And that really defined why George Lucas made the choices he made and what he did with it. So I'm going to give you guys the briefest of brief history lessons. Bear with me, we're going over a lot in a very short amount of time. It's about 300 years worth of content. I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to the Sky Talkers. They had a really great three-part History of Lucasfilm Animation podcast in 2020. So a lot of the sources you see in this is I discovered through their show. So I did want to give them a shout out because they did that work and then I deep dove on it. So, all right, animation. It is one of the oldest mediums in our world. Scholars believe that we have been trying to bring pictures to life since the prehistoric era. And the Industrial Revolution was a really big deal. The magic lantern was the earliest form of a projection system. But also, there were all sorts of inventions. One of my favorites that I always mispronounce is the phonetoscope. And a big one was the zoetrope. And we need to make sure we keep an idea on the zoetrope. The zoetrope is important. If you're a George Lucas scholar, you know what the zoetrope is and where I'm going with the zoetrope. And so, because of the Industrial Revolutions, technology was being shared all over the world. And these ideas allowed animation to evolve as these ideas were being shared. And a big one came, though, in 1917, when Max Fleischer of Fleischer Studios would patent the rotoscope. Aha. So I can't even begin to talk about how important the rotoscope is, but it's one of the most major inventions in animation. Because prior to this, animation didn't have realistic movement. But coming up with this very simple concept of what if we just draw on top of a living person, and then animation had this realism it never had before. Fleischer should really get a lot more credit. He should be a household name, but Disney kind of took over that because Disney would really popularize the idea of the rotoscope. But also, it's such an important invention because a lot of scholars consider the rotoscope the precursor to motion capture because it is the same concept and idea. You take a person and put character on top of it. And rotoscoping is also why we have lightsabers. There's a really great 15-minute documentary about the creation of lightsabers on the Star Wars YouTube. And George Lucas said that lightsabers are half live action and half rotoscoping. But there would be one thing that would change the course of animation, and that would be Steamboat Willie. We do not have time to go into how big this mouse was, but a very short version is this is why our copyright laws are the way they are. But Steamboat Willie was so big it would kick off what was called the Golden Age of Animation. This is where a lot of our very popular characters were created, and the reason this era was so big was it coincided with the Golden Age of film as well. The biggest one would be Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We would be in a very different world if this was a flop. But because Snow White was such a big deal, this would dominate what is called traditional animation through cell animation. And this is how animation would work until the computer era. And Disney's Nine Old Men, which were a group of animators, came up with the 12 principles of animation, and this would be studied all over the world. However, there is one problem with this that we're going to come back to repeatedly for the rest of this hour. Animation is expensive, guys. So expensive. And a good example of why this is expensive, George Lucas's bestie, Steven Spielberg, gave a speech to AFI in 1978. And while he didn't talk about it being expensive, he laid out why. And he discussed how he believed all live action directors should work with animation first. And he gave this analogy of a chipmunk rolling down a hill. In live action, you can just film a chipmunk rolling down a hill. But with animation, you have to think of every angle of the chipmunk as it rotates. You have to create the hill. And this is why animation is such an expensive medium. So this is the golden age of animation, and then we very quickly went into a very changing world. The 1920s in America were wildly unregulated, and then very, very suddenly the Great Depression hit, and the world changed instantly. And movie studios went, uh-oh, people aren't spending money. So they really sensationalized movies to try to get people in the audiences, and it was very much of like, if you don't see this adult content, then you're never going to live again. And you know who was really unhappy about this? The Catholic Church. The Catholic Church would make what is called the Motion Picture Production Code. It's more commonly known as the Hays Code. And basically what this was, the Catholic Church went, yeah, you can make whatever movie you want, but 20 million Catholic people across the nation doesn't have to see your movies. And studios went, uh-oh, well, we better make them happy then. And this would actually later turn into what our filming rating system is today. So you might be wondering, like, what's in the Hays Code? Some of it is very, like, common sense things like no graphic violence, no non-consensual adult content, things like that. But some of the more silly things is, like, no women in power because, God forbid, a woman doesn't have a husband. And, oh my God, clutch the pearls. What if two men are in love? Oh my goodness. And, of course, this is America, so there had to be a healthy dose of racism because you couldn't show people of different races together. My personal favorite is you couldn't ridicule and make other countries look bad. So some early Nazi films slipped through before they went, oh no, wait, Nazis are bad. And you might be thinking, Hope, we're supposed to be talking about the holiday special in Star Wars television. Why are we talking about all this movie stuff? Well, that's because it is the precursor to what is called the Television Code of 1952. And it would be the Television Code and the fact that animation is expensive that would set the stage for the holiday special. So to get to the first one, it was built on top of the concepts of the Hays Code, as well as what was called the Communication Act of 1934. This is what would create the FCC. And it was because of a series of things called the quiz show scandals. We don't have time to get into those today. They're really fun to read about. But basically, quiz shows were supposed to be live and people found out they were scripted and they were big mad about it. And so religious groups really pushed to have more regulation on TV because it was this brand new thing. And it was first really challenged in 1976 for violating the First Amendment. That date is important because the holiday special is 2 years later. And so this is your Leave It to Beaver era. You couldn't like make families look bad. It had to be a nuclear family, people in two beds, all that. And we're actually still seeing repercussions of the Television Code today. One of the big, where the Hays Code was guidelines, the Television Code was law. You would get censored, you would get fined. And one of the big things that we still see is they were required to have time slots for religious programming. This is why if I turn on my television tomorrow, I will see Joel Osteen on my TV. So this immediately started breaking down as early as the 50s and the 60s. And a big reason was America was changing. We had just come out of two decades of a lot of conservatism with the Great Depression and World War II. But in the 50s and 60s, we were having the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, the women's rights movement. And a big thing was actually having a television, because with World War I and World War II, if you wanted to see what was going on to the world, you had to pay money to go to a movie theater and see propaganda. But with this, people were actually watching the Korean and the Vietnam War happening, and people went, uh-oh, wars are bad. And so the Television Code was challenged multiple times and amended multiple times until 1983 when it was abolished. That date is important because 2 years later was Droids and Ewoks. And then there was also television in the animation era. Does anybody know what's wrong with television in the animation era? You want to say it with me? Animation is expensive, guys! So the difference between this and the Golden Age is movie studios were not pouring money into animation anymore. So television studios had to figure out ways to make animation and make it cheaply. So there's these concepts called limited animation that came about. This was not a new thing, but it was really made in the 50s to the 80s. And everybody has their own form of limited animation. If you watch anime, Japan's version of animation is different from America's, but it's still the same concept. So it's a lot of things like walk cycles. If you think of a traditional episode of Scooby-Doo or Flintstones, they have the same like cycles and it's the same thing over and over again. And the thing about this is it really heavily relied on voice acting and scripts. Though the cool thing about this is we've been really recently seeing limited animation coming up a lot in 3D spaces recently. And one person that's been really pushing and pioneering this is Genndy Tartakovsky in his Hotel Transylvania series. And we'll be talking about him very soon for very specific reasons. One of the first people to really push this idea was the United Productions of America, or UPA. This was founded by a group of ex-Disney employees that saw what Walt was doing and going, no, animation does not have to look realistic. We don't have to follow the 12 principles of animation. That's not what animation is. So they were really the first to pioneer this idea of animation on television. But it would be Hanna-Barbera who would become king. This is the group that would create the idea of the Saturday morning cartoon. And sadly, though, this is also where the negative stigma that cartoons are for kids comes from. Because prior to this, animation was seen as lowbrow, but it wasn't seen as for kids. But because of this idea of the Saturday morning cartoon and a lot of kids were watching it, this is where that idea came from. And this period would become known as the Dark Ages of Animation. Which is not fair, because Bill Burnett, who was the creative director of Hanna-Barbera, wrote a series of 15 essays. And the very first one says, when the theatrical cartoon was on death's door, William Hanna and Joseph Barbera single-handedly, or rather double-handedly, rescues cartoons from oblivion. As a cartoon blues man might say, if it wasn't for limited animation, we wouldn't have no animation at all. Hanna-Barbera would also launch the career of Genndy Tartakovsky. And Tartakovsky was heavily inspired by the work of UPA, who we just talked about as well. So, fun fact. Because that's really important in a minute. So this was the world when, this is the world and the state of television when a dude named George Lucas decided to make this thing called Star Wars. Do I need to explain to the Star Wars convention what a big deal the original trilogy was? Do I? Does anyone not know what A New Hope is? Because you might be in the wrong place. Okay. But I will talk to you about why animation was important to George Lucas. His very first movie he ever made was called A Look at Life, and it was for an animation class. The thing about George is he always saw Hollywood as a means to an end. He's very much a person that went, I will make your blockbuster, but then I will take my Star Wars money and invest it in things I actually care about. And one of the things he actually cared about was funding, was co-founding a company called American Zoetrope with Francis Ford Coppola. And this company really focused on working with other artists so they could make really high art that wasn't held captive by the studio system. And George Lucas said in Starlog magazine in 1985, I've always been interested in animation. And again, it's a chance to experiment with ideas and new people and Star Wars characters. The Star Wars world is much easier to deal with in animation. You can be much more flexible in development of ideas. I've been putting it off for years because I didn't have the time. This was in relation to Droid and Ewoks. And now we're at to one of my favorite things of all time, which is the Star Wars Holiday Special. I love it. If you don't know, it is a variety show that aired on November 17th, 1978. It came out between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. George Lucas didn't work on it very much because he was making Empire Strikes Back. And it starred B. Arthur, Art Carney, Harvey Korman, Diane Carroll, and it had Mickey Morin, Paul Gale, and Patty Maloney as Chewbacca's family. And guys, it went bad. It was not well received at all. Fans and critics hated it. But the reason it was a variety show was because variety shows have always been popular and they've always have survived through vaudeville to radio to television and film. And because of the flexibility of variety shows, they were also able to weather the storm of the television code of 1952. The 70s were also wildly experimental because we were in the tail end of the television code. And it wasn't fully gone, but it was really breaking down during this time. So because of the nature of it, sure, they can have a cooking segment that's drag and blackface. Why not? If you wanted B. Arthur to sing a campy number with a rat man nuzzling her, sure, why not? If you wanted to have a animation segment in the middle of it, sure, why not? It's a variety show. And that gives us the story of the Faithful Wookiee. It is the only part of the holiday special that George Lucas actually worked on. And because we were in the dark ages of animation, this Hanna-Barbera world, George wasn't really impressed with anything coming out of California at this time. So the director of the holiday special, David Akamba, introduced Lucas to a studio he had never heard of. And that would be Nelvana. Nelvana is the groundwork for all Star Wars television. Nelvana is a Canadian company that was founded by Michael Hirsch, Clive Smith, and Patrick Lubert, and they are considered the first major animation company out of Canada. And guys, you have seen something Nelvana has done. They are one of the most prominent animation studios in the world. If you were like me and you were a 90s kid, when it was Magic School Bus Day, that was the best day. And so they have touched pretty much everything in our childhood, which is why it was so crushingly heartbreaking when I was making this presentation for y'all, that last week it was announced that Nelvana is going through a lot of troubles and Corus, who owns them, is working towards shutting down their animation division. It is a 50-year legacy that looks like it might be coming to an end. It is still up in the air at the time of this recording, but they are ending all their current projects, and we do not know where Nelvana is going from here, which is sad because we are talking about their legacy for the rest of this presentation. So why did George Lucas choose Nelvana? Because it was really weird. This company was less than 10 years old, and they were dirt broke. They were so poor, they were working next door to a smelting company, and it smelt like fish. And they had no major works at this time, except for this little TV special called A Cosmic Christmas, which David Akamba showed them. They were so broke that Michael Hirsch, one of the founders, when he was called down to LA, he was scared he wouldn't afford George Lucas's Taco Bell, because George Lucas wanted to go to Taco Bell to have this meeting. Because I love George Lucas, of course he wanted to go to Taco Bell. But he was scared he couldn't even afford it. John Slattery, who worked for Nelvana, explained really concisely why George loved this company. And he said, animation in the United States at the time was very commercial, but in Canada, it was still informed by a European sensibility, a sense of art and design. A Cosmic Christmas did not look like anything that was coming out of California at the time. A Cosmic Christmas dealt with characters from outer space seeking answers. The show was complete before Star Wars had been released. It showed that Nelvana and George Lucas were on the same page intuitively. And if this does not sum up Star Wars, I don't know what does. It was a traditional theme in a non-traditional manner. And so they became working on the story of the Faithful Wookiee. And it was a very fast production. It was only a matter of weeks. And it was definitely really hard because George did not want it to be rotoscoped. He did not want them to draw on top of the actors. So Nelvana got to work and George loved them so much. He was like, hey, do you want to introduce this brand new character named Boba Fett? But all they had to work on was the Joe Johnson and Ben Burtt Boba Fett test footage. It's that white armor, if you've ever seen that footage. That is all they had to work on. And a little description of Boba and what he was. But Nelvana would also design Fett's iconic weapon, which would in turn become Din Djarin's weapon in The Mandalorian. And they were also heavily inspired by Mobius, which is one of George's favorite artists. And if you also know what else was heavily inspired by Mobius, it was A Sunny Day in a Void, George Lucas's favorite episode of Clone Wars, guys. Because of course that's George's favorite episode. So when Hirsch and Smith went down to LA to present the storyboards and all the early work of a Cosmic Christmas, A Faithful Wookiee to them, they were met with a bunch of really, really famous people like George Lucas, Ben Burtt, and Ralph McQuarrie. And Hirsch was saying how for the next hour, nobody said anything, and he did not know if his production was going well. And when he finally reached the end of showing them and presenting the storyboards, George Lucas stood and gave them a standing ovation and totally gave them the full reins to make The Faithful Wookiee. And I know it looks rough now. I know it looks silly now, but you have to understand there was nothing else like this on television for animation. Compare this to Scooby-Doo or Flintstones or any of the other things that were coming out in this time period. So yeah, Han Solo looks like a melting wax figure of Benedict Cumberbatch. But this was such a big deal. And George Lucas loved working with Nelvana so much that he would bring them back for round two. This brings us to what is called the animation age. So television code is gone. And it's... Aw. Are you okay, Chewie? Okay. This is the television code is gone, but the one thing I didn't really talk about was it had very strict regulations of what you could advertise to children. And the person who did not like regulations was Ronald Reagan. And one of the few things he did was he deregulated this law. This opened a floodgate to what is called merchandise-driven television. If you lived in the 80s, you understood this if you lived through it. And the whole concept was make show, sell toys. Sell toys, make more show. And why this is different from the dark ages of animation was because they were making merchandise and toys that in turn funded animation. So more money was being poured into it. And something that Nelvana really popped off with was both He-Man, but Care Bears. Care Bears is what put Nelvana on the map. So this was a time period when Nelvana was doing really great, guys. They were like really doing great. And George Lucas went, hey, I love your work, but also I know you can make shows that makes merchandise. Let's team up again. Because one thing that George Lucas was always really good about was understanding how important merchandise was to Star Wars. If you ever are mad because it's commercialized, blame George Lucas. This is why he always wanted the merchandising license with him, because he understood that toys and merchandise keep Star Wars in people's brains. But again, he's George Lucas, and he wanted to elevate this idea of what the Saturday morning cartoon was. And the reason he chose droids and Ewoks is because Wicket and his little indoor village and R2-D2 and C-3PO were the least likely ones to impact the movies in case there was ever going to be more movies. So when he sat down with early works on this, he sat down with the creators and went, okay, let's look at Joseph Campbell, and he studied religion and mythology and pulled from a lot of cool things like Lord of the Rings. And fun fact, one of the people who worked on droids and Ewoks was Paul Dini. Does anybody know who Paul Dini is? Who's Paul Dini?
Paul Dini went on to work on Batman the Animated Series, one of the better pieces to come out of animation in the 1990s.
Exactly. He's the co-creator of Harley Quinn on Batman the Animated Series. He has a lot of really cool interviews where he talks about working with George, and you can kind of see that through line from George Lucas to Batman. So, good one.
You mentioned that Luke Skywalker played the Joker in that one?
Oh, yeah. Mickey Herman, who was the executive producer of Droids and Ewoks, said George Lucas wanted to raise the standard of Saturday morning programming for children. His main complaint is the acting. We wanted to put real feelings into the show, happy feelings, some sadness and comedy, humor. Comedy is very important to us. The bottom line is that animation is a manufacturing process. Much of what you see on television now has 8,000 to 9,000 cells to make a half hour's animation. Droids and Ewoks will be about 20,000 cells per show. We want a richer show, and the more cells, the finer and richer animation. George Lucas decided that he wanted to do double the amount of what anybody else was doing on the market at this time. There is one problem with this. Does anybody know?
Animation is expensive.
Thank you! Animation is expensive, everybody! A single episode of Droids and Ewoks costed anywhere from $250,000 to $300,000. They were some of the most expensive single episodes for that time period. In comparison, a 1997 episode of South Park cost the same amount. It was so grueling for Nelvana, too, to keep up with the production demand. Ewoks was a little bit more forgiving because animal characters are very forgiving. Droids, not so much, because 3PO has fingers. 3PO has limbs. He has expressions. And to go back to that chipmunk analogy, there would be scenes where C-3PO would float and rotate. And every single one of that is a drawing, because George Lucas is kind of crazy like that. And because it was such a grueling production, we also had to deal with the television code. Because even though it was still abolished, the television code had given networks so much power. And Michael Hirsch said in his memoir, I think one of the problems we ran into is that the Saturday morning network TV had too many restrictions on violence. We weren't allowed to show anything that kids might imitate, so our weapons looked more like vacuum cleaners or channel changers than Star Wars weapons. While the Ewoks in the movie were cute, they were also warriors, and that tension got in the way of making it into a successful kids series. The plan to do a multi-part episode became a challenge because ABC's standard and practice forbade children's shows from ending on cliffhangers. We had to design every episode to complete itself. Cable TV, which was not bound by FCC regulations, would be a better home for later Star Wars spinoffs like The Clone Wars. My favorite episode, way that ABC would meddle with these shows came from Paul Dini. He talked about in Star Wars Insider number 27 that he had written this episode called The Starman. What the Starman was that an Imperial pilot crash-landed on Endor, and the Ewoks found him, nursed him back to health, and when the Empire came, he had to choose between helping the Empire and helping the people who had saved his life. And doesn't it not sound like an episode of Star Wars, right? Do you want to know why it got canned by ABC and never made? In the words of Paul Dini, it was too Star Warsy. What? So these were the two big problems for Droids and Ewoks. It was an incredibly expensive show, and there was a lot of meddling from ABC. This is why Droids would only last for one season. Ewoks did get a second season, but if you look, season one would have like 20-minute, would have full episodes, but season two were two 12-minute episodes in one, and the animation and the story was drastically toned down because Lucasfilm brought it in-house, and this would be the first TV production that was brought in-house for a Lucasfilm. So that would, for now, end Nelvana's role in Star Wars. Hold on. We're doing good, guys. It's fine. So we would go into like a 2-3 decade period where there was really no animation happening and there was no television for Star Wars happening. But that does not mean that George Lucas was idle. This was the time period where he was really focusing on creating the Pixar Image Computer. And Industrial Lights and Magic was really popping off during this time. And they were developing new technology. And this is my assumption, but I think there was a lack of technology that was really frustrating for George. Michael Hirst said in his memoir, "While we were working on the Star Wars show, George introduced me to John Lasseter, the head of Lucasfilm nascent CGI production arm that would be known as Pixar when it was later sold to Apple. George would have liked to have used computer animation for Droids and Ewoks. The technology wasn't there yet, but John was on a critical path to building it." Because that's the thing about George, like, he's always forward-thinking, and he wanted to try and do these things, but he didn't have the technology at the time. But as I said, that doesn't mean that ILM was being idle. Joel Aaron gave a really great interview during Bad Batch Season 2, where he talked about how a lot of the techniques they used on films like Jurassic Park and Pearl Harbor, they would in turn apply those themes, ideas, and concepts to Clone Wars Season 7, the Tales series, Star Wars Rebels, and the Bad Batch and beyond. And that brings us to a little thing called the prequel trilogy, and probably what a lot of you guys are really excited to talk about. The Clone Wars 2D series! Who's a fan? Yeah. So you want to know what the funny thing is? For a company that holds on to everything, including like napkins of Dave Filoni, we actually don't know a lot about the early production. And the information that we do have contradicts each other. But basically what happened, either Hasbro went to George or George went to Hasbro. And they were like, "Hey, we want merchandise to help promote the prequel trilogy. Is there a way to do this? And let's figure it out." And during this time, there's a guy named Gendy Tartakovsky. And he had been really coming a long way from his early Hanna-Barbera days. And he'd just come off a show called Samurai Jack. And if you've never seen Samurai Jack, it was one of the biggest things that Cartoon Network has ever done. And because it had this very unique style, Hasbro thought that Tartakovsky would be a really good fit for the Star Wars project. So they would bring Tartakovsky and Cartoon Network to Lucasfilm, and they presented these ideas that would become the Clone Wars 2D series. And George loved it. He was like, "Yeah, this is great. Let's greenlight it." Because it was made to sell toys, this is why the early episodes are only 1 minute to 3 minutes long, because they were basically toy commercials during this time. However, the 2D animated series was so wildly popular that they were like, we need more. We need to make this bigger. And George Lucas loved it so much, he went, I want you guys to introduce the villain of Revenge of the Sith. This is General Grievous. Use him in an episode, and they are some of my personal favorite episodes. And even though it wasn't her first appearance in Legends, it was the first on-screen appearance of Asajj Ventress. And she became such a big, popular, wildly popular fan favorite character that she just had basically a backdoor pilot earlier this year in Tales of the Underworld. And she just celebrated her own 20-year anniversary just a couple years ago. And Clone Wars 2D would also be the beginnings of some of the talent that we have today. James Arnold Taylor, Tom Kane, and Corey Burton would all go on to reprise their roles as Obi-Wan, Yoda, and Count Dooku much later. And a lot of the talent that we have in Lucasfilm Animation got their start in the Clone Wars 2D series. However, there's one thing about Tartakovsky. He loved the work of Nelvana. He was a huge fan of Nelvana. He especially loved C-3PO and how expressive 3PO's eyes were. Bless you. And that is why that his C-3PO looks the way he does. And he's so expressive in the Clone Wars series because he had this deep love of Nelvana. Tartakovsky loved Nelvana so much that he created the planet of Nelvan. And those are the Nelvanians. That is how he decided to immortalize this company that meant so much to him that when he was growing up, he loved the holiday special and he wanted to make sure Nelvana always had a place in Star Wars. Well, George went, hey, that 2D Clone Wars thing is really cool, but it kind of is very inspiring to me. So in 2003, in the LA Times, a very quiet press release came out and pretty much George Lucas went, I'm going to start Lucasfilm Animation. And this is the Lucasfilm Animation that we have today. And the fun thing about this press release is it's, of course, 5 years before The Clone Wars comes out. And it was like, we sure hope that George Lucas has great things in his future. Go figure. But this would also be the time that they would break ground in Lucasfilm Singapore, which would be a huge animation branch up to about 2 years ago when it sadly shut down. But George needed help. He couldn't just go and do this Clone Wars thing on his own. And he wanted to bring in a new protege to kind of take the reins of Lucasfilm with him and to teach him the ropes of Lucasfilm. And he saw this upstart animation director who had worked on other things before, but this guy had only directed animation for 8 episodes of Avatar The Last Airbender, and only in season 1. But if you look at these episodes of Avatar, you can definitely see the through lines from that to what we're about to talk about. And this person kind of got Nelvana, just how George saw this very young animation company and went, no, they're the ones I want to work with. He saw this young animation director and went, he's the guy, I want to work with him. And when Lucasfilm called this person, he thought he was being pranked. And he was like, what is Lucasfilm Animation? Like, that doesn't even exist. What are you talking about? That's not a real thing. And of course, I'm talking about Dave Filoni. Dave Filoni is now in Star Wars, guys. And that brings us to The Clone Wars, which Tartakovsky was really not happy about at all. So Dave came in to work with George Lucas, and he decided to give his pitch of his idea. And the original pitch that Dave gave to George was this idea of a team of Jedi and smugglers who would work together on a really cool ship in the underworld, and they would occasionally run into Anakin and Obi-Wan, just on occasion. And when I read this, I was like, this kind of sounds like the early concept of Star Wars Rebels. And you want to know what George Lucas said to this idea? No! From how Star Wars conquered the universe, Lucas considered Filoni's idea and then shook his head. No, he said, according to Filoni. I like my own characters. I want to get Anakin and Obi-Wan in. But there was one thing in Filoni's sketch that gave George an idea for. I want to give Anakin a Padawan, he said, pointing to a sketch of Ashla. Let's take that girl there. And that would become Ahsoka Tano, who is probably one of the most revolutionary characters that we've ever had out of Lucasfilm Animation. But there's one problem with this, guys. Can anybody guess?
Animation is expensive.
Say it louder!
Animation is expensive.
But don't worry, guys. George Lucas is funding it this time. George did something that was wildly unprecedented. He personally funded season one and made all 22 episodes before ever going to a network. This is not the norm. This is not how it works. And each episode costs $750 to $1 million an episode. And once he had this completed first season, he decided to go out to all the networks, and he was very tenacious about it. He went about it with an all or nothing mentality. And he went, you take all of it, Jar Jar episodes included, or you get nothing. And from George Lucas Life, he said, it's much easier just to do the show I want and then say, here it is. Do you wish to license it or not? That's it. There's no notes, no comments. I don't care about what your opinion is. You can either put it on air or you don't. And even then, studios were really lukewarm to this idea of the Clone Wars. Even Cartoon Network, which had the 2D series that it was wildly popular with. And they weren't sure if they really wanted to have this full season. And it wasn't until George Lucas went, sure, I will give you a movie too. I have a movie ready. And Time Warner went, cool, a movie. That means merchandise. And merchandise means money. And so then George Lucas would Frankenstein the first three episodes into the Clone Wars movie. Which, fun fact, is my second favorite Star Wars movie. I love it so much. Don't judge me. And this would become the building blocks of what we know now as Disney Plus. Because as they were making season one, a creator would come into the Clone Wars to work on his own projects. And he met Dave Filoni. You might have heard of this person, actually. He has a few sleeper hits. I don't know if you've ever heard of the movie Elf or Iron Man or this thing called The Lion King Live Action. And that last one is why that guy happened, because Donald Glover was just like, don't announce a Baby Yoda. Just drop it like a Beyonce album. Which Hasbro was really mad about because they had no toys ready for Christmas. And of course, I'm talking about Jon Favreau. Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni met as season one of The Clone Wars was being made, because Favreau came to Skywalker Ranch to work on Iron Man and to work on the sound design. And his kids were really big Star Wars fans, and Dave Filoni really wanted to see what Iron Man was. So they met, and Dave Filoni was like, if you let me watch some Iron Man, I'll let your kids watch some Clone Wars. That is how they met. And at the time, they had this like Mandalorian character that needed a voice. And while it wasn't for season one, he was like, hey, John, you want to voice this character? And John was like, sure, why not? In an interview in 2013, Dave Filoni says, I have this Mandalorian guy. I don't think he's going anywhere. It was true at the time. He was just a one-off in the middle of Voyage of Temptation. He had like two lines and we never see the guy again. Then George Lucas really liked the character of Pre Vizsla and so expanded him to have this whole story. And we had to call Jon Favreau back. I know you're busy, but this became a much bigger deal. So what's fun about the Mandalorians is their designs would actually pull directly from the holiday special. They really loved the design of the Nelvana helmet, and this would become the idea and the basis of George Lucas's version of the Mandalorian. I know it made a lot of Legends fans mad because it really contradicted a lot of the Mandalorian lore that came from Legends, but this was what George Lucas wanted. And I just like the fun fact that they have the sign there. I have to give some credit where credit is due for this next point, because what is really fascinating to me is that the Clone Wars is the basis and the bridge between Legends and canon. My friend Charles, who actually works at Legacy XO, so if you like him, what you're enjoying, make sure you say thanks and hi. He talked about on his podcast, Gold Squadron Gaze, about how Clone Wars bridges this too. Because the first six seasons of Clone Wars were made pre-Disney acquisition. And season seven was a Disney property. And through Clone Wars, we took all these ideas and concepts from Legends, filtered them through Clone Wars, and then built upon them in the new canon. And we're seeing more and more canon characters, or Legends characters, come into canon, like Thrawn. And these ideas and these concepts are coming into canon because of Lucasfilm animation. And even then, something like The Bad Batch is kind of the end of George's legacy, because the early concepts of The Bad Batch were made for that pre-Disney Clone Wars era. And they would take these ideas and concepts and apply them to what would be the season 7 Bad Batch episodes, but also the season 2 episodes of The Bad Batch Tribe. And these ideas and these concepts of how the Wookiees and the designs of their houses came from Ralph McQuarrie's drawings of the holiday special. And so the final part of this, of why this all built to the way it does, is Dave is George's protege. George Lucas gave everything to Dave Filoni and said, go forward with Star Wars. And as his protege, if you want to know what Dave Filoni has done in the Disney Plus era and what he has covered, everything. Dave Filoni has worked on every single major Star Wars television show in one way or another, either as a creator, an executive producer, a writer, a director, or a consultant, because he is the chief creative officer of Lucasfilm now. And every show has to go through him. So whether or not you like The Acolyte, it had to go through Dave Filoni first. And that all came from Nirvana. There was this very humble beginning to Star Wars television, and it started with the groundwork that Nirvana made. They laid out the holiday special and Droids and Ewoks, and it was so incredibly inspiring to someone like Genndy Tartakovsky. And Genndy took this idea and these concepts to make his own Clone Wars series. Clone Wars became such a wildly popular show that George Lucas went, I want to do that. I want to launch Lucasfilm Animation. And through Lucasfilm Animation, we ended up having Disney Plus. And again, to go back from the slide from earlier, we're seeing more and more of the importance of the holiday special. The holiday special is continuing to come back in books and comics and references. One of my personal favorite is the Lego holiday special, where they actually brought back Chewie's family. I love that one. It's one of my favorites. But this concept of Life Day is continuing. And Life Day has become very important, both as fans and in the normal Star Wars universe. We, in November, we celebrate Life Day as fans. Also, Disney was like, let's make money on this, because of course they did. And so this, I hope that one day we might get to see another holiday special. And Jon Favreau kind of wants one too. For a Mandalorian event, he was asked about the inspirations of the holiday special on The Mandalorian. And he said, oh, I would definitely be interested in doing a holiday special. I've been thinking about it. It's ready. The ideas are ready. I think it could be really fun. Not as part of this, but there's an excitement around it because it was so fun and weird and off and not connected to what Star Wars was in theaters. The Mandalorian cartoon, the Boba Fett cartoon from the holiday special, was definitely a point of inspiration for what we did in the show. The show is The Mandalorian. So maybe we'll get a holiday special in the future. I personally hope that Nirvana returns in Star Wars Visions one day to do The Faithful Wookiee 2, because that's the crazy person I am. But for now, guys, happy Life Day. Woo! You guys want to hear how Akmina, Mala, and Gormanda are Andor level characters?
Yes.
Okay. I'm not talking about writing. Because that is not what I'm talking about. What I mean by that is when you look at something like the original trilogy, those are the big mythical leaders of life, of the rebellion. And rebellions are more than that. Rebellions are a group of different kinds of people. Yeah, you have your big heroes, but you also need people like the accountants. You need people to make food. You need people to run errands. You need people to pick up trash in rebellions. And I'm talking about real-world rebellions as well. And the thing about Akmina, Mala, and Gormanda is it was really the first time we saw how the Empire impacted real people and impacted their everyday life. We wouldn't get stuff like that even until, like, I would say the Clone Wars show, like the Clone Wars, not Clone Wars 2D, to see how these concepts of Star Wars impacts everyday people. If you really think about Mala, essentially she's just trying to have Christmas and she's trying to make dinner and she doesn't know where her husband is. She doesn't know if he's even alive. And then suddenly the state police break into her house to terrorize her. And that's terrifying. Like, when you actually think about what's happening in the holiday special, it's a really terrifying kind of thing. And then they're forced to watch Akmina's segment. And yeah, it's a John C. B. Arthur song, but pretty much the state police is going, watch how we're going to terrorize this woman as propaganda. And what I love about Akmina is she outsmarts them. She goes, hey, I'm going to get my people to safety under the watchful eye of the Empire. And she does. She gets them out to safety. And in Legends, one of the few things, I know I'm a baby Legends fan, but in some of the few things I know about Legends is Akmina becomes a slave rebellion. Like, she leads a slave rebellion to free slaves under the Empire. And that's so cool of her, and I love her for it, and I hope she sings songs the whole time. But, like, we never really had these concepts of how the wars in Star Wars impacts normal people. And something that Andor does really well is show how fascism invades a small town and takes over. But the holiday special was really kind of the first version of that. And if you look at Legends around Gormanda, and she actually says in the show, like, she's teaching people how to eat on a budget. There's a galactic war going on, and her little part of rebellion is teaching people how to eat another day on a very, very cheap budget. And that's what rebellions are made of. They're made of people teaching people how to cook. They're made of people trying to have Christmas so their son can be happy another day. And, like, Mala might not be the greatest heroine, but, like, she is keeping her life together to make sure her son has a good Christmas because she doesn't know if her husband's alive. And I think that's really badass of her. I think that she's really cool to do that. And Akmina would go on to be a slave leader. Like, a slave leader. A slave rebellion leader, not the other one. And I just think they're really cool characters. Like, that's what the thing I love about the holiday special is, it's all these really cool ideas that we would learn and, like, kind of go through in later Star Wars. And it was really the first to do these kind of concepts and ideas that we would explore in other medias. And that's why I really dig it. I think it's fun. It's a mess. It's a mess. I'm not saying it's not a mess and it's not crazy and weird, but it is a lot of really cool ideas that we would apply in other later Star Wars. And I just think that's neat. So. Cool. Yeah. I finished on time. Yeah. Yeah, 1 minute. Well, I'll let you guys out 1 minute early. So, I'm 1 minute over? Yeah. I said I would be a minute over. Thank you. Thank you. Well, guys, thank you for coming. If you enjoyed it, I hope you did. So, I hope you guys enjoyed my panel. And next up is my interview with Barbara Hambly, and I will see you guys on the other side. Enjoy it.
I really enjoy this convention. It's, yeah. You know, I was here last time, and it's just a completely delightful con.
That's good. That's good. The first thing I wanted to actually ask you, because you talked about it earlier in your author panel, was how you actually got your start writing fan fiction. And I'm a fan fiction writer, and I think fan fiction is a very important part of fandom.
Yes.
And it's also a very important tool for writers.
Yes.
And so I was wanting to know what you thought more about that, about the concept of fan fiction and fandom spaces and how writers can use those things, because I use it to practice writing. And I wanted to hear more of your thoughts about fan fiction, actually.
Oh, I was writing, I guess, what you would call fan fiction from the time I was about 6 or 7 years old. You know, when I started reading the Oz books, I would write Oz stories. When I started reading Sherlock Holmes, I would write Sherlock Holmes fanfic. I think fanfic is a really good way to practice writing, because if you're particularly It gives you a chance to work on techniques, the technical aspects of writing, without trying to come up with a setting, trying to come up with a who are the characters, what are their relationships. These are given to you. And if you watch the show, if you've watched the movies, if you watched whatever it is fanfic of, you know the setup. And so what you need to do, what you can concentrate on is getting the characterization right, getting the descriptions right, and then as your writing matures, you can start coming up with your own characters, your own settings, but you already know how to keep a story going, you already know how to do dialogue. If you're watching the show, or you're watching the movies or whatever, you're subconsciously picking up, how do you do dialogue? You're learning, okay, none of those people I'm watching goes into a 15-minute monologue. You don't get these big chunks. You get, okay, couple of lines, next person, couple of lines. And it teaches you some of those subconscious mechanics of writing.
Yeah. And fan fiction, historically speaking, has always been kind of a female-dominated space, dating back to some of the actually earliest works of Sherlock Holmes and the pastiches that was written about that. I was so excited. I immediately texted my friends at 221BCon, and I was like, Barbara Hambly wrote Sherlock Holmes fanfic. I was very excited about that.
One of the things that really interested me when I read the book David Copperfield, Charles Dickens' book David Copperfield, at one point the narrator mentions reading stories and then writing, inventing in his head other stories about those characters. And I'm going, caught you, Mr. D.
You wrote fan fiction.
But as a medievalist, as a student of the Middle Ages, reading the Arthurian legends and the way it was a shared setup. Everybody knew about Camelot, everybody who knew who the knights were, everybody knew what the setup was, and all over Europe, you're getting people writing, oh, I'm going to write a story about Gawain. I'm going to write a story about Sir Bors. I'm going to write a story about the time something or other, about the time Percival went and did whatever. And I'm going, that almost feels like the same roots as fan fiction. Because it was a shared universe that people wanted to participate in.
I mean, historically speaking, the only reason it's called like fan fiction is because we have copyright laws. Like, prior to that, people would just be like, hey, I like this Jane Austen book. I'm going to write my own version with my own characters or with these characters to see what happens next.
Well, if you try to publish it, you're going to get in trouble.
Now you can.
Well, even in Jane Austen's era, mm-hmm. there were pirate editions. But if you look back at, for instance, the Grail legends, you know, I did an infamously long research paper on the Holy Grail legends, which is why watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail was so entertaining, because it was obvious that one of those guys, and it was probably Terry Jones, studied the Grail legends. Because I kept running across things that I go, that's from the this, that's from the that. Mm-hmm. But with a number of the Grail legends, you'd have the original Grail legend, which ends, it doesn't come to a conclusion. And then sometime later, 20, 30, 40 years, you have somebody else picking it up and continuing it. And then they were prevented in the middle, and then there was a second continuator. And you encounter this in a couple of different legend cycles in the Middle Ages, and I'm going, this feels a lot like fan fiction.
I get that. Something to kind of go back to Star Wars, because we were at a Star Wars convention.
Of course.
You, of course, wrote the romance between Luke Skywalker and Callista. But romance is sort of this weird topic in Star Wars. My friend has a saying that the only time there's romance is when there needs to be a very important baby. But why do you think that romance is actually very important to the Star Wars universe, if you think that at all?
Any story you're going to tell picks up resonance if there is a personal story involved in it. If you're writing about saving the galaxy, it really helps if you have a personal story running in it, a personal story running parallel, because you can't be doing laser battles for 200 pages.
No, those are my least favorite stories.
Yeah. And
I am not a pew-pew Star Wars person.
Well, somebody told me, I heard at a workshop or something, that most good stories are stories of redemption, of someone coming from a dark place into a light place. And romance falls under that category, is you're coming from a dark place into a light place. And it could be connected with saving the galaxy, and it could be the hero's friend finding what they're looking for. It's some kind of an emotional conclusion other than, you know, oh, we've defeated the Empire and saved the galaxy yet again.
Yeah.
Well, someone has found who they love yet again, but...
That's what I think I wish that Star Wars kind of tackled more, because a lot of, frankly, men write Star Wars. I feel like romance is often an afterthought, but I don't... Or it's written to be kind of like... Some people say it cheapens characters, but I don't think so. I don't think romance cheapens characters at all. I think it gives them depth and more.
It depends on the writer.
That's very true. That is a very true point.
There are so many things that a good writer can make this work. A bad writer couldn't make Romeo and Juliet work.
Yeah.
And so much depends on who's writing it. Is it good writing or is it bad writing?
Mm-hmm.
In the hands of a poor writer, you betcha that romance is going to cheapen everything.
Yeah.
In the hands of a good writer, it lends an unforgettable, or it can lend an unforgettable resonance.
Yeah.
But it's like playing the guitar. It looks really easy, but you have to be really good for it to sound good.
I tried to play guitar a few times and it went poorly, and I went, this is not for me.
Yeah, me too.
So you, a lot of men have written for Star Wars, and we're starting to see more and more women writing for Star Wars, but there weren't a lot of women writing in Legends. You're like one of the few. And so why should women be writing Star Wars and giving our point of view and our voice to this galaxy?
Because everyone who has a point of view and a voice should be, if this is the kind of story they want to tell, everybody should be participating, both men and women, should have the social permission to tell the story they feel they need to tell.
Yeah.
And for a long time, in science fiction in general, it was considered a man's genre. You know, women can't write science fiction because their brains don't work that way. And then somebody goes, including a rather famous science fiction writer saying, C.L. Moore has one of the most driving and masculine points of view I've ever seen, and C.L. Moore is a woman.
Yeah. Science fiction was invented by Mary Shelley, a teenage girl at the time when she wrote Frankenstein.
So, yes, yes.
Like, people don't tend to forget that, like, it's because of women we have science fiction.
I wouldn't say Mary Shelley invented science fiction.
Well,
Mary
modern,
Shelley invented, modern. Yeah, the more modern science fiction, because you go back to people, there was an ancient Roman who wrote about life on the moon. The poet Cyrano de Bergerac wrote about the states and empires of the moon and the sun. It goes back a long ways.
It really does.
But Mary Shelley was the one who came up with the trope of the mad scientist and the trope of you create something and then you can't control it. Or you create something and you can't accept the responsibility for what you've done, which is the actual story of Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
which is the reason that I love the movie Young Frankenstein, because it is the only Frankenstein story that addresses that central problem, where the creator takes responsibility for the person he has created.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, for a movie that silly, to get to the heart of the problem. What is the problem?
Yeah.
And, you know, like somebody else said, all you need is love.
That is very true. One thing that you said earlier really resonated with me. And you said, all paintings are done in the same colors, but not all paintings are the same. That might be the best advice I've ever heard for a writer. Because as someone who struggles with my own imposter syndrome, I always need to be reminded that, like, that just because my story might be similar to somebody else's story, that doesn't mean it is. And I just wanted to first personally thank you for that, because that was a very powerful thing to say. But if you had any other advice to, like, writers, something like that, what would you tell them?
Get somebody you trust to read your manuscript, and if they say, this is not working, at least look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Advice my husband gave me, when you get stuck, walk back along the road to the last crossroad and take the other road. It's what happens when you get stuck on a story.
Mm-hmm.
Or else just take a walk. You know.
That is very true.
You know, other advice I would have is get plenty of exercise. I'm not sure what kind of advice I should give.
Honestly, that quote that I read was so needed for me right now.
Okay.
Because you have written all sorts of genres. You've written fantasy, historical fiction. I was excited to learn about vampires because I'm a big Anne Rice fan. Crazy as she is, I love Anne Rice.
Well, that's an example of you're painting a different picture in the same colors.
Yes, it really is, because when I've read other vampire writers, we don't have time to get into my thoughts about Anne Rice. That's a different interview. But how did you apply going from different genres to your own writing, and how does writing in different genres affect each other? Like, do you bring your time with fantasy into your historical fiction, or vice versa?
In a weird way, it's all the same. Mm-hmm. When I'm writing fantasy, I'm not really thinking in a different way than when I'm writing historical fiction. It's all about world building. It's all about sources of power. It's all about who were your parents and how did they live? How did you become who you are? Why are you doing what you do? What are the obstacles to solving the problem? And whether you're using magic or you're not using magic, you're solving the problem. And sometimes you discover that the problem that you think you're solving is not really the problem.
I liked what you said earlier, that writing characters is very important, and that that is the drive of your work, because that personally is how I drive my work as well, is my work is very character-focused. And so why does that work for you, like focusing on characters versus... Well, I guess the better question is, do you more let your characters drive the plot, or your plot drive the characters, or both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I know who my characters are. I write a moderately detailed outline before starting a project, which if you're writing a murder mystery particularly, you have to do. Mm-hmm. Because you have to know what you're looking for. You have to know where you're looking for it. You have to know... Murder mystery is two things. It's two stories. One story is what was the crime that was committed. Second story is how did Holmes and Watson figure out how that crime was committed? And maybe that's what fascinates me about writing murder mysteries. But what... Even if I'm not writing a murder mystery, if I'm writing a fantasy, I have to know what's happening. Generally, my works are puzzle stories. So what's happening and how do we figure out what's happening and what do we do about it? It's like one of my favorite films is the old 1951 version of The Thing from Another World, okay. Which is... Okay, what's the problem? How do we solve the problem? And yet, going on in the background, there's a romance, there's conflicts of authority, there's a reporter trying to get his story in, and the commander is saying, no, you can't send this in. You mean I can't send this in? And that's, he's a comic character. You have, and I think that's why I enjoy the film so much, is you've got a whole bunch of little stories operating behind, there's a thing from another world! Which I think was the reason that I did not like the John Carpenter remake, was because it did not have all these little human elements going on in the background.
Because at the end of the day, like, stories is... What makes stories great is because they're so human. Those are my favorites, at least, is the most human stories. Barbara, I wish we had more time, because I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Thank you for giving me some time out of your day.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
I hope you guys enjoyed all of that. Just so you know, coming up is the next two episodes is from friend of the show Colton's panels at Legacy Expo. They wanted a place to house their panels and we gave the okay. So I don't know which one we're doing next, but you will hear those panels next before we get back to Bad Batch after that. So, all right guys, thanks for listening to Jagaz and Jedi, and we will see you next time. Bye!
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled T-W-O-T-R-U-E-F-R-E-A-K-S. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Test, test, say duh.
Duh.
Good luck.